From WBUR Boston and WRNI in Rhode Island, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Kenneth Lay was supposed to be in the hot seat today on Capitol Hill. Instead, the embattled former Enron chief turned a cold shoulder to Congress and declined to tell his side of the Enron story. As America waits for answers and understanding, there is growing fear over how widespread this kind of corporate duplicity may be. In this hour, we ask, how deep is the rot? And examine a potential crisis of confidence in the way America does business. We begin with a closer look at Kenneth Lay. Last month, he resigned as chairman and chief executive at Enron. Today, he was a dramatic no-show for congressional hearings on Capitol Hill. But much is now public about the Enron chieftain. Yesterday, the Washington Post ran a long profile by Lois Romano. Earlier, I asked her to describe this man who didn't show up today.
He truly is a man who does want to talk. You know, I went into a profile I wrote on him for the Washington Post with different notions than I came out with. You know, from a distance, he seems sort of the epitome of corporate arrogance, greedy, you know, your basic guy who made hundreds of millions of dollars and then cut and run. But when I started reporting the piece, it turns out that he gave away, you know, almost as much as he made. He was a very generous man, more of an egghead than a corporate baron.
Do you mean literally that he gave away? He made something like $112 million in the last couple of years.
Well, okay, not literally. But he gave away, I think, about $20 million over the last 5 years to the arts and, you know, things like the United Negro College Fund, the YMCA, United Way. And just as importantly, he took the lead on a number of major charities in Houston. I talked to a guy who runs the Nonprofit Development Corporation in Houston that helps build up downtown, and he said to me that Ken Lay set the bar high, and he basically became the civic role model for giving, for corporate giving. He's very highly regarded in Houston.
Yeah, you describe him, he's a PhD in economics, he's avuncular, approachable, go-to guy, civic patron, and yet he was the guy in charge of the ship that has gone down so spectacularly.
Well, there's no question, Tom, he was asleep at the wheel. And that is going to raise a lot of questions on how liable or how criminally liable he is. You know, the standard, my understanding, you know, the federal agency standard is a corporate executive had to know or should have known what was going on. And so, you know, there's a question of whether he was negligent or not, and that remains to be proven.
The report that came out from the Enron's board of directors over the weekend was fairly scathing, saying that ultimate responsibility does lie with Ken Lay.
As the captain, right?
Yeah, as the captain. In this same avuncular personality, is there something that might have been blind to this, or is there another side that would have encouraged it because Enron needed these deals to make it go forward?
There's no question he approved the deals, but there is some evidence that two things happened. Over the last few years, he was disengaging from the company. He had turned over the reins of the company to Jeffrey Skilling. So even though he was the CEO up until last February, Skilling was, in effect, running the company, which is no excuse, but that is in part what their defense is. In addition to that, it appears that he had direct oversight responsibility for these partnerships. I think it was called the Office of the Chairman, and there appears to have been some negligence in that regard, that they did not monitor them as they should have.
You're right, he was the son of a Baptist preacher and salesman, interesting combination, and that he, like his father, was a relentless optimist. Do you think that somehow he thought that it would all be pulled out of the fire, or was he selling knowingly his own stock and watching others do the same as Enron went down the tubes?
I can only tell you what the reporting bore out, and his family and even people at Enron who were supporters of Skilling say that he really didn't know until the end, that nobody knew, that even though the stock was plummeting, that he really thought he was going to turn it around. Now, on the sale of his stock, in a number of cases, he put into place an automatic sell. And so he had no control over what price it sold at. And so he gets a little bit of a pass there, too.
Though he knew it was being sold, obviously.
He knew it was being sold, but he was able to put it on a three-month sell program. So it wasn't like the stock was on this plummet and then he was rushing in and selling. I mean, it was stuff that was put in motion several months before. But the real larger question is did they see it coming earlier in the year? I mean, the stock has been kind of, it was slowly going down from last spring, and then it took a deep dive, and did all of them know? I mean, you know, you had Jeffrey Skilling saying he wanted to leave because of his family. You had Cliff Baxter, the fellow who committed suicide a couple of weeks ago, saying that he had it, he wanted to leave because of his family. Like, all these people that were on the top of the ship all of a sudden want to have some private time. And so it does raise a lot of questions.
And then, of course, there's his wife's famous appearance talking about how they are having liquidity problems and everything's for sale except the home they live in.
What does a
$7 million home, just a poor little hut that they're left in. What else is on the market? Is it really on the market, or does he still have an empire of vacation homes?
Some of this is unclear, but we know that all three houses in Aspen are on the market. And, in fact, two houses and a lot were on the market. They were going.
Did you say three houses in Aspen?
Three.
What does one do with three houses in Aspen?
I asked that question, Tom, and they use them apparently.
You know, like moving around depending on their mood for different interior.
No. He has
color
one
scheme.
House which is called a cottage, which is the smaller of the three houses, and that one's worth about $3 million as opposed to $6 million.
Mm-hmm.
The $6 million homes, which are across the street from each other, are used a lot by family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they were places to put his money, but he used them all.
How does he feel about his friendships? He was famously, supposedly friendly with George Bush, who now says, we're told, I thought the captain was supposed to be the last one off the sinking ship.
Exactly.
This stinks. Does he feel abandoned by his one-time friends?
I think he feels more hurt. And I also heard he was angry that this was becoming a tar baby for Bush, you know, that they were bringing Bush into it.
Mm-hmm.
My reporting also bore out that he was not that personally close to the Bushes. They basically had a political friendship. He was a major and significant and important fundraiser across the board for the party, for the city. And he helped the Bushes during the Republican convention.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm told that, you know, he was not somebody who was in the inner circle. He was not somebody that went to the ranch, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So bottom line, Lois Romano, do you see this from Ken Lay's point of view as a dream gone awry or as a giant scheme?
I guess I see it as a dream gone awry. I mean, if I had to put my feet to the fire,
mm-hmm.
I don't think he saw this coming.
Lois Romano is a reporter for The Washington Post based in Tulsa. It's hard to believe now, but it's only weeks ago that most Americans had never heard of Enron. Now everybody knows its name, and day by day it's come to symbolize deeper trouble in the U.S. economy. Today, Wall Street saw stocks crumble again on fears that corporate corruption goes far beyond Enron. The front page of the Wall Street Journal reminds us today of an earlier era, the 1930s, when corporate scandal left investors with brutally diminished confidence in American banks, corporations and accountancy, the basic institutions of American business. Is a crisis of confidence brewing in the way America now does business? What needs to change? What can we count on in an era of bogus corporate books? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us now from Austin, Texas, is Professor Henry Hugh. He holds the Alan Schiffers Chair in the Law of Banking and Finance at the University of Texas School of Law and teaches courses on corporate law and securities regulation. Good evening and welcome, Henry Hugh.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our own on-point news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Henry Hugh, we're looking at the news straight off of Wall Street today. Dow Jones today down 2.2%, 220 points after a big fall on Friday as well. People are talking about Enronitis, a confidence-sapping malaise that has Wall Street questioning the honesty of corporate financial statements. Are we flirting with or into a crisis of confidence in the way America does business?
There is a possibility of some kind of tectonic shift. There is a fundamental, you know, concern that's going on that's driving the nervousness and increasing nervousness on the market. When you fly a commercial airliner,
mm-hmm.
There are, you know, two engines, the idea of redundancy. And the basic test, I understand, is that the engines have to be strong enough that if one of them fails, it can still get you over the Rockies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, here we have a situation in terms of Enron where it seems, based on published information,
mm-hmm.
That in effect you have four engines, all of which failed.
Describe them for us. What's gone wrong here?
That, you know, if the facts are as is being portrayed, you know, one, there's a failure at the board level, at the center.
Mm-hmm.
Second, in terms of capital market discipline, that is, institutional investors and outsiders and analysts who either didn't see them coming, see the disaster coming, or who were unwilling to fully, you know, disclose what was happening.
Right.
Third, in terms of the banks and other creditors, the lenders, who apparently were surprised at some of these problems in terms of, you know, everybody mm-hmm. from Morgan Chase to Citibank. And then fourth, in terms of the product markets, in terms of the wholesale markets. That
now, what do you mean there?
For instance, that the fact that Enron, up until a few months before the demise, was actively involved in terms of trading derivatives and things like that, and people were happy to trade with them.
People were trusting them as a market for their
trusting.
Business.
That's right. So that it's not just, one bird being sucked into an engine and then the plane falling, and in which case you don't, you take your chances and get on the plane. Here you have a situation where not a mere Fortune 500 company, mm-hmm. not a mere Fortune 100 company, but supposedly the number 7 company on the 400 mm-hmm. list, where all four engines somehow fail, and if the facts are as being bandied about.
Yeah.
So that there is this concern of, in terms of general nervousness that seems to be increasing almost by the day. It's perceptible. That is, that now you have a situation where there's a hint of an accounting problem, and the impulse on the part of analysts as mm-hmm. well as on the part of investors is to sell first and ask questions later.
And we see those tremors going right through the market now. Tyco got hit today big time. Global Crossing has been hit. Even General Electric has been hit today after there were questions about complicated financial structures. It was only a week ago this seemed like an Enron story. Is this now an economy-wide story? And if it is, what are the implications of that, Henry?
Well, in fact, this Tyco thing was particularly startling because, the last time I checked, it had fallen something like 18% today. Mm-hmm. And this is on top of, I think there was one day last week where it fell about 20%. Tyco was, commonly regarded as kind of a mini General Electric.
But we've got a situation where people were already concerned that price-earnings ratios were out of whack, that stock prices were too high. Is what you're saying that now people are afraid that across a wide front there may be sort of cooked books, which means companies are not even doing as well as investors thought they were when they were already nervous?
Well, there could always be disparities between what the intrinsic value of the shares mm-hmm. are and what the trading price is. That's inevitable. You have a funny situation here that if you look at traditional measures of value like price earnings ratio, mm-hmm. dividend yield, the total market capitalization of the stock market relative to the gross national product. If you look at any of those measures, traditional measures, they all seem to point in the same direction. That is that the stock market on an intrinsic value basis is substantially overvalued, like twice as high as what it should be.
But that we're used to. That we've known for a while.
Right. But here you have a situation where and these kinds of gaps could last for quite some time. But here you have a situation where you see like a major company like Enron, not some dot-com startup suddenly mm-hmm. creating, or not some hot NASDAQ security collapsing such as in the spring of 2000, mm-hmm. but you have, in a sense, a major Fortune 500 company right at the top of Fortune 500, and you have a large company like Tyco suddenly falling, that in terms of, Tyco, in terms of these day moves of 20%.
It's got everybody's attention. Henry Hugh, stand by. Henry Hugh is professor of banking and finance law at the University of Texas School of Law. Jack Beatty, what do you hear? We're moving beyond Enron here, are we not?
We are. We're into a structural problem of capitalism first identified by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, who is no fan of the corporation. He said that the problem endemic to a corporation is negligence and profusion. The manager manages, he doesn't own. And negligence and profusion run all through this story.
And yet we want to believe in this system. It's brought us mountains of wealth. We can't let it go. We'd better fix it. We're talking tonight about a potential crisis of confidence in the current American way of business sparked by Enron. Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a potential crisis of confidence brewing on Wall Street and around the country, sparked by Enron, but now spreading wider as investors and Americans look at the way American companies have come to do business in the late 90s and early 2000s and said, you know what? This doesn't smell kosher. What do you think? Are you confident in the way corporate America's numbers are holding up? Have you stashed your savings under the mattress yet? Are you thinking about it? Are you still right on board? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Professor Henry Hugh from the University of Texas Law School. He teaches banking and finance law. Henry Hugh, what about this issue beyond Enron? How widespread is the rot, and what do we call rot today? Are there practices that became absolutely commonplace in the late 90s that are now coming back to bite us? How widespread is the problem?
Certainly the market seems to be signaling that the problem goes substantially beyond Enron, in terms of the punishment that different stocks, everything from Tyco to that biotech company today, to other companies that people think that this might be, in a sense, a systematic problem. That is, that there has been concern over the past couple of years in terms of aggressive earnings management. The SEC and others have worried, for instance, in terms of various revenue recognition issues involving dot-coms and the like, and that now there's this general perception that perhaps people have been overly aggressive in terms of earnings management. And one of the very interesting issues will be that if these companies in general end up becoming more conservative in terms of reporting earnings,
right,
suddenly we'll see earnings that are lower. Mm-hmm. And what does that do to notions of whether it's an expensive market or not? If somehow the more conservatively reported earnings that start coming out suggest that the price-earnings ratio now is actually much higher.
Even worse than before.
Yeah, even worse than before. So I suspect that part of what may be happening is that, you know, even accepting kind of the earnings at face value and so forth, the price-earnings ratio by historical standards are high, and then if it turns out that, you know, the real price-earnings ratio is even higher, then it may help explain some of this nervousness in the market.
Henry Hugh, we have listeners who are total experts in this and others who are not. Explain for those who are not what you mean by earnings management.
In terms of the numbers you report.
On profit?
The profits you report, that the generally accepted accounting principles gives you some wiggle room in terms of what you report.
How you define your profit or your earnings.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. How you define your profit or earnings, and that there are things that you can do that are allowed for GAAP that, in a sense, smooth out your earnings growth so that if, you know, you would normally be a company subject to the vicissitudes of the vagaries of the economy so that your earnings might go up one year and then down the other year, that the world is lumpy.
So,
right?
But in this system, you can smooth it out with fancy accounting.
Right, and that under so that even within generally accepted accounting principles, there are ways of doing that make it seem as if, in a sense, your company is a less risky enterprise.
Mm-hmm. So if this is happening endemically, it goes to the issue of risk right across the board. But is there a way, can you somehow quantify for us, Henry Hugh, how far off true north the economy or American business practice has drifted?
Well, I don't think you can do that. Because you would have to know every company and the true intrinsic value of the company. And there's a second layer of problems in that, you know, there is a relatively tenuous connection between earnings per share and your true economic performance. Mm-hmm. Earnings per share, that is the accounting profits, are kind of an artifact of accounting rules that are very non-economic space. They don't take into account key themes, key valuation drivers like risk and time. And so that we're talking about a number that in and of itself is not too, you know, terribly meaningful to begin with. And then if people play games to kind of undermine the integrity of those not terribly meaningful numbers to begin with, then you're left, you
really
know,
wondering.
Really adrift.
Jack Beatty, Henry Hugh describes us as being in a non-economic space.
Yeah, you know, he gave four engines there that are supposed to keep this this plane from crashing as it goes over the Rockies, and how all four failed. But so did the traffic control system.
That being?
That is to say, the government. Mm. You know, Adam Smith, his negligence and profusion that he saw endemic to corporate management because the manager doesn't own, he's using other people's money, his incentives are not there to save money. He can be profuse and he can be negligent. That was, in his view, to be corrected by competition. It could only work, he thought, and prolong itself under conditions of monopoly. There you can get negligence and profusion for years, as you got it with Enron. Well, the role of monopoly in this scenario was played by the government, by the regulators, by the Congress, by the entire surround of ultimate responsibility that allowed all sorts of accounting obfuscations to pass without regulation. The Wall Street Journal today has a long piece about a particular kind of financial instrument that Congress, that the Treasury Department wanted to regulate, and the Congress was lobbied, and the Congress said, no, you can't do that. Mm. And it was intrinsic to this whole business. Now, so politics is the surround, and we hear today, of course, that the Justice Department, which is run by a man who received campaign contributions from Enron, is not going to appoint an independent prosecutor. And we also hear to look into the question, and we also hear that they are not even looking into the question of influence peddling. They are looking instead into whether the Enron Corporation made false claims. Mm-hmm. So they are giving the Dick Cheney connection, a pass, not only through the independent prosecutor, we're not going to have one, but through what they're looking for. And, you know, we had an independent prosecutor for Monica Lewinsky. Mm. We had one for Hillary and Whitewater.
Yeah.
And here, in the largest financial scandal in U.S. history, a Justice Department under the shadow of recusal says we don't need one. This is part of the scandal that allowed those four engines to fail and that the whole thing to crash.
Jack Beatty, Henry Hughes, stand by. We have a mountain of callers who want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. Jeffrey is on the line. Welcome, Jeffrey. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to throw my little 2 cents in here.
Good to have you. 2 cents and all.
Petty as it may be. I guess I have a couple of points to make. The first one is, as you well know, we cannot legislate morality. People have tried. It doesn't work.
Okay.
The
meaning?
Second point, people seem to be looking in all the wrong places for solutions to this problem by trying to create new accounting standards, new oversight boards, and, you know, new ways of watchers to watch the watchbird.
Okay, give us your second point, and maybe we'll see where you're coming from here, Jeffrey.
The second point is that, in addition, it's extremely important to look at the root causes of all this.
Where do you find them?
And they are found in the structure of American corporations. The American corporation is governed by a patchwork of state laws. Most of the large corporations exist under Delaware law, which is extremely friendly to management and the board of directors. So my proposal is that we stop talking about trying to whack the accountants over the head and having special prosecutors.
Okay.
And look instead at requiring that all major U.S. corporations that are listed be federally chartered under a system which creates qualified outside directors on the board that are responsible to the shareholders and don't take any nonsense from management. You have seen this done.
Jeffrey, I think we got it. I want to put that to Henry Hugh. Henry Hugh, do you see a prescription in what Jeffrey is proposing? He says, forget about the special prosecutors. Let's get a tighter system of corporate governance across the board.
I agree totally that we need a tighter system of corporate governance. I don't know whether federal chartering, which is what Jeffrey talks about, would do the trick. That is that this idea in terms of federal chartering as opposed to state-by-state chartering of corporations was suggested by William Carey back about 20, 30 years ago, and that really didn't go very far. The key issue is in terms of corporate governance, one of the really central issues is having an effective board. I agree totally with Jeff. And one aspect of the report is how it criticizes the board here at Enron mm-hmm. for not being more careful. And of course, I should disclose that the dean of the law school I teach at, was head of that committee, so I should just disclose that.
it's everywhere. It's in the air. Henry Hughes, stand by. We're joined now by David Wessel. He is with the Wall Street Journal. He is news editor for the Washington Bureau of the Wall Street Journal. He writes the weekly Capital column on page 1 of the Wall Street Journal. He's co-author of Prosperity, the Coming 20-Year Boom and What It Means to You. Good evening and welcome, David Wessel.
Thanks to be here, Tom.
Good to have you, David. David, we're talking tonight with Henry Hugh at the University of Texas Law School and our news analyst Jack Beatty and our callers about what we see in the markets on Friday and today and in the all over the front page of the Wall Street Journal, this kind of crisis of confidence that we're either in or flirting with. What's going on here? Is this bigger than Enron? Henry Hugh describes it as a tectonic shift. Do you agree?
I think it's definitely bigger than Enron. I think there are people who would like to paint this as a few bad apples at Enron and a few incompetent apples at Arthur Andersen, and there's nothing wrong with the system.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that a number of other companies have had to fess up that they did things that were similar, that is, they essentially, if they didn't lie, they certainly misled people with their financial statements. And one of the things that one has to wonder now, one doesn't know, is this going to be a watershed like the great stock market crash of 1929 was, which led to the creation of the Securities and Exchange Commission
mm-hmm.
and these very accounting principles that we're now finding wanting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's some reason to believe it is, both in government and I suspect some of the big institutional investors, the pension funds, are going to start stomping their feet a little as a result of some of these mishaps.
Stomping their feet for tighter regulation and stomping their stock, their money right out of the stock market?
It will be interesting to see if they insist that companies have more independent boards of directors, have audit committees that are more independent of management, that perhaps rotate auditors so you don't have the same firm auditing you every year for 25 years. And if this one of the things, a self-correcting mechanism, I'm not saying this is going to happen, I'm
mm-hmm.
not terribly confident as well, is that companies that have financial reports that no ordinary human being can understand will find it harder to sell securities and borrow money than other companies.
David Wessel, you're right there in Washington. You're talking also in pretty dire terms here about a potential real stock market crash as a result of this loss of confidence. You feel the climate in Washington.
I'm not saying there's going to be a crash. I think the question is whether this becomes a watershed event that leads to a set of reforms the way the crash did.
Okay, we're relieved in that case. We'd rather have it that way, and thank you very much. Do you feel, I guess the same question stands, in the climate in Washington, the readiness to get aggressively into this, backfiring engine and get it fixed?
I think it's an open question. I think when I joined the conversation, you were talking about exactly the problem.
Mm-hmm.
On one hand, there's a great uproar now about this terrible thing that happened. But the Congress has not turned its gaze on itself and the ways that it is partly responsible for this thing by succumbing to the demands of lobbyists for Enron and the investment banks and so forth. And so there's a tension here between their rhetoric, which
mm-hmm.
is very self-righteous,
yes.
and this history of bowing to pressure of people who had connections and made campaign contributions.
What might it take, what will it take to get the Congress and the White House out of a potential position of hypocrisy and really to grips with the problem?
Well, I think that these guys have very good political antenna, and if they find that there's sort of a more widespread public disgust with the behavior of corporations, or if they feel that the stock market and the system is threatened by a parade of horribles of one company after another saying, oh, we're restating our profits, and by the
right.
way, we did some things, that could create a climate in which they have no choice but to do reforms that they have refused to do in the past.
It's a pretty hair-raising scene. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Terry's on the line. Welcome, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to talk a little bit about what I'm hearing from my family members and
mm-hmm.
people in my group.
Tell
us. One of the things that they're saying is AARP just sent out a newsletter.
The retired people's?
Yes, the Association of
mm-hmm.
American Retired
okay.
People. And my folks went around last week spreading their money around to different banks.
At the advice of the AARP, Terry,
yes,
or just on their own?
Yes, they're saying that a lot of the banks now, yes, they felt that they started to read in the AARP that one of the biggest banks, Bank Boston, is a borrower to Kmart and the Argentine.
Lender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lender. And they're really nervous about that, and they want to invest their money just like I do, and we don't know where to put it. There's no place to save it anymore.
Wow.
And there's a lot of talk about, well, you know, what do I do? I can't keep it in a mutual fund.
Mm.
And it's like our institutions, you know, all of the acronyms of our institutions have let us down, the SEC, the IMS, the CIA. And there's really, I feel, there is a crisis of confidence. I really feel that's true, but we're all so busy that we're hoping somebody else is going to take care of it.
Terry, we hear it, and we appreciate your call. Henry Hugh, what's your advice to Citizen Terry and her family who are wondering where to put their money and what to do now?
Well, if I knew where to put the money, I'd be sitting in the Bahamas, right, and sipping pina coladas.
Okay, but hang in with us before you go down and join the Enron guys there.
Right, right. Well, I think that Terry brings up a terribly important point, which is Terry was mentioning, gee, you know, what do I do? I don't know what to do. And that brings up the point in terms of the secular shift to defined contribution plans from defined benefit plans.
And this is the 401k plan that came up, yeah.
Exactly. The shift from the old-style pensions were these company pensions where the company would basically promise to pay you, say, 80% of your highest salary for the rest of your life.
Yeah, and it ain't so now. Henry Hugh, I want to get back to David Wessel just before we lose him at
sure.
the break. David Wessel, you wrote about the 20-year boom, and we want to believe in it. Do you see it threatened by what's going on right now?
Yes, but I think the one thing that's important to tell the caller and other people who are listening
Please.
Is that the idea that you can't put your money in the bank because of this is just not right.
Good.
The
Thank
government
you.
Of the United States stands behind accounts and banks up to $100,000, and there's no reason to believe that anything that has happened has changed that. On your point, basically, I'm still pretty optimistic about the capacity of the American economy to withstand shocks like this. I think that this is a serious threat, but my guess is mm-hmm. that we overcome it, that we'll have a combination of reforms and shakeouts that will have a bumpy road for a while, but that the same forces that we saw, some of the same forces that we saw in the 90s, essentially the ability of technology and innovation to continue to lift living standards will not be permanently disrupted by this ugly episode.
We're heartened, and we want to get it fixed just as soon as we can. David Wessel is Washington Bureau News Editor for The Wall Street Journal. He's author of Prosperity, the Coming 20-Year Boom, and What It Means to You. David Wessel, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure.
Good to hear your voice. We're talking about a crisis of confidence in the American way of business, sparked by Enron, now spreading to other countries up and down the big board. What do you feel about it? How's your confidence in corporate America's numbers holding up tonight? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight, we're talking about a crisis of confidence in the American way of business. Enron may be just the beginning. Is the system self-correcting, or do we need new intervention to set things right? Is Enron just the gorilla in the gold mine? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Henry Hugh. He's professor of banking and finance law at the University of Texas School of Law, and by a lot of callers that we want to invite in. Jonathan is on the line. Welcome, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Yes. I want to comment on something that I believe is a structurally corrupting influence, and that is the practice of compensating executives on the basis of the share price.
What's the consequence market. Of that bothers you, Jonathan?
Well, the share price is subject to perceptions, whereas if they're compensated on the basis of the economic profit of the firm,
mm-hmm.
that's fine with me. That's the cost of staying in business in the future.
How do you draw the lines between what's happened with Enron and other companies and this practice, very widespread, of compensating on basis of share price?
I don't. I think that it is corrupting everywhere it happens. I mean, it's a structural thing that induces people to shade the truth.
It's certainly become endemic. Jonathan, thank you very much for your call. Henry Hugh, what about Jonathan's point? Do you see compensation based on share price as something that's been a corrupting influence in American business?
This is a tough issue because if you do what had been done before the widespread use of stock options, that is, look at, for instance, your earnings per share or the gross earnings of the company. There are all kinds of things that you could do to artificially boost the earnings, such as if you simply cut out research and development, because R&D, research and development expenses are simply deducted, that you can immediately increase earnings per share, but that would harm the long-term health of the company. So that one of the decisions to move to a stock option-based or a stock-based compensation system to look at the share price was a notion that the share price would be kind of like a valuation device. It would look at the future prospects for the company so that it gives a truer measure in some sense of how you're really doing for the company.
A value barometer, but it's based on the notion that there would be honest inputs to that evaluation.
Exactly. One critical element to that is lots of clean information to the capital markets.
Jack Beattie, how do we fix this without killing the golden goose? I mean, you know, we're bashing corporations tonight to a certain extent, or at least certain kinds of behavior. That's an important distinction. On the other hand, a lot of value has been created here, and a lot of jobs and a lot of wealth, and that's something we never want to lose.
Yes, but I think the question is, are these structural faults necessary to those good things? And I don't think they are. I think, in fact, they're impediments to it. I mean, I think a system where there's been article after article about the scandal of the board of directors. We've had it in Boston. We've had it elsewhere, where members are essentially bribed. They're made consultants. Their charities get contributions. Their businesses get patronized by the business they're supposed to be looking over. Now, that's the kind of thing, it seems to me, that's capable of a structural fix. That is to say that the manager of the company should not be allowed to pick his board. And yet, typically, that's what happens again and again.
Jack, let me bring callers in here. We've got so many. I appreciate that point. We've got a lot of callers. Dick is on the line. Welcome, Dick. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the show. It's excellent.
Thank you.
I'd like to just comment on a thread I see that we've gone through a lot of deregulation. In fact, I think the country has grown to like it an awful lot. But I think in many cases it's gone too far. I'd like your guest to comment on Arthur Levitt trying to put a little enforcement into separating out the consultancy and auditing by the auditing agencies, and that he was unable to do it because he got a lot of calls from senators who had gotten from both sides of the aisle who had gotten contributions didn't want that to happen.
Couldn't get auditing reforms.
He basically had to stop it.
Dick, you've given us a lot to chew on. I want to put that to Henry Hugh. First, Henry Hugh, on this issue of deregulation, it was supposed to bring us all the value of the market in squeezing out waste, and we'd still like to think that could be true. You're in Texas where the regulation is a big issue around energy. What's the future of regulation and deregulation?
Well, I suspect that we're going to be, just as 9/11, the events of 9/11 have pointed out the necessity for government. I think the events of Enron suggest a role for government, a vigorous enforcement of laws and vigorous enforcement of disclosure, compliance, and that sort of thing. In terms of the point that Dick raised about the separation of consulting from auditing, in general, that I think probably does make sense because of the concerns over real or perceived conflicts. But in thinking about the issue, you also have to look at the downside, and to be very quick about it,
yes,
one of the concerns one might have is what quality people are you going to be able to get to go into an accounting firm that simply provides auditing services? Maybe there are some people that are thrilled with the idea of putting on green eye shades and going over books and so forth. But you really wonder in terms of the ability to attract enough really talented people in terms of that area.
Henry Hugh, you open up a vista that's almost I don't know how to take on board. We're too smart or ambitious individually to go out and just be green eyeshade guys, and yet Enron needed green eyeshade guys.
Honest ones.
Honest ones.
No. My point is a different one. That is that you need some very smart green eyeshade types.
Yeah, I got it. But you say if you take away the consulting fun, the smart folks may not want to go in and just be green eyeshade accountants.
That's right. You have a concern over enough highly qualified people. So, but mind you, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you in terms of the conclusion, but it's just that when we think about these kinds of proposals, you have to look at the benefits as well as the costs, and that it may turn out that the benefits to separating the two are dwarf the costs, but one should be aware of them.
It's going to be a time when we need exquisite, good, and upright judgment in sorting all this out. Henry Hugh, thank you so much for spending the hour with us and taking us into the issue tonight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Henry Hugh holds the Alan Shivers Chair in the Law of Banking and Finance at the University of Texas Law School. He teaches courses in corporate law and securities regulation. Jack Beatty, there's UT Law School and via David Wessel, the Wall Street Journal, weighing in and saying, hey, folks, we've got a big situation going on here.
Yes, a crisis of confidence, and here's where regulation can actually help to mitigate that, and helping to mitigate that is going to help the economy. So here's a case where regulation and growth, that is to say the constituent of growth, which is confidence, are on the same side. And yet I see today in the Wall Street Journal that the SEC, which is going to presumably lead any new regulation, has got barely any budget increase at all from the Bush administration. So there's a lag there, it seems. But regulation is crucial to ending this crisis of confidence.
And a shakeout of some kind, at least of candor, on Capitol Hill, where all the campaign contributions went. Jack, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
For ongoing coverage of the day's events, go to our new website at onpointradio.org. West of Mazar-e-Sharif, on the barren fringe of northern Afghanistan, 3,500 Taliban soldiers wait in Sherbagan prison. U.S. troops have examined the prisoners and taken several to Kandahar, but the rest remain packed in dark and fetid quarters. Dr. Jennifer Leaning, a member of the board of directors for Physicians for Human Rights, recently visited the Sherbagan prison. In this radio diary, she takes us inside.
It was a cold, bright, sunny afternoon, and we drove up in our old Land Cruiser down this narrow, dirt, rutted road lined with trees and saw the vast high walls of a old cement prison in front of us. Inside the prison, it was bleak, barren, packed earth throughout the entire vast compound, small little ugly concrete buildings scattered around, unclear what was what. But in the far distance across this vast football-sized ugly rough field, we saw these looming cell blocks that we guessed were where the Taliban prisoners were held. Walked across this vast rough furrowed field into the inner compound where the cell blocks were, and there we saw the prisoners. They were massed up against the steel bars of the prison, and the cells behind them were along a central concrete corridor, and the high walls ended in vertical open bars so that there was light going into these cell blocks, but also the wind, nothing blocking the full exposure to the elements. And these guys were thin, gaunt, very young, huddled in thin cotton shirts and very thin blankets, some without shoes, on the concrete floor of the cell block. They looked at me directly, dark brown eyes, full, thick beards. Some of them had just shaved their heads. We could see actually locks of black hair on the mud compound where they'd been released to do this. Several of them grinned and ran their hands over their recently shaved heads and said, through translation, lice, bugs, filth, we had to do this. And they were upset about the conditions. They, you know, held my gaze and they said, tell the United States that we need some food. We need warm clothing. We're dying here. We all have dysentery. It's freezing. This is not a place for animals. We wouldn't keep our animals in this place. These were young men who were able to stand up and talk with us. We could see that there were 18 cells going back along the corridor behind them, and we knew there were thousands of men behind there. The prison commander had told us that each of these cell rooms was designed for about 10 men, and they actually were holding 80 to 100 men in each of these rooms. So my concern was that behind the men I was talking to were men who were much sicker. There was also an infirmary where the sick prisoners were held. And when we asked to see the infirmary, the commanding officer was a little reluctant, but he let us do it. And here there were 8 men lying on battered old cots, no mattresses. The air inside hit you like a wall. The smell was stronger than almost anything I have smelled, and I've been a physician in a lot of areas in the world. So this fetid, heavy air, just thick with the smell of feces and filth and pus, was the first assault. And then the second assault was seeing how ill these men were and the fact that there was absolutely nothing of medical significance in the room. No intravenous fluid, no signs of medication bottles, no medical charts, no medical equipment, not even a blood pressure cuff. These were very young men dying very far from home. The commanding officer said, many, many, many have already died. That was a quote. We said, do you have numbers? And he said, no. We were not surprised to hear that because the toilet facilities, to get blunt, were 8 to 10 toilet holes per 1,000 men. The only water source for the whole prison was one little water tap that came out into the central courtyard, emptying into a 10-foot muddy trench that was the place where these 3,000 or 3,500 men could attempt to wash up. The men had nothing to clean themselves. In fact, the commanding officer said that the men would go out into the adjacent field and find dirt to wipe themselves off with. So it was a death cycle here. These men are dying from dysentery, pneumonia, and probably hepatitis A. These were very young men dying very far from home. The majority of these men are not going to last the winter. Whatever these young men had done, they were now in the hands of the Afghan government and behind them the United States military, because we had led this war, we had conducted it, we had our forces on the ground that arranged for the capture of these men, and our military had been in this prison for a matter of weeks before we were there, interviewing the prisoners and selecting the ones they wanted for further interrogation, taking them to Kandahar. They'd been there. They'd seen the conditions. And then they'd left. I'm carrying many images of Afghanistan with me. I've been back for a short week. But among the images are several of the faces of these young men whose gaze I caught in the Shebregan prison. And I wonder about how they're doing. It's happened to me many times now this week. I feel a cold wind, and for reasons I can't pin down, I find myself thinking, are they still alive? Does anybody know what's happened to them? Are we going to be able to make any difference?
Jennifer Leaning is a member of the board of directors of Physicians for Human Rights. She lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. To see photographs from her trip to Shebregan Prison, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence.
This is WBUR, where